Mr. Chief Justice, it pleases the court.
So I am not a person who likes conflict by nature, but there is a caveat to this, which is loose my shoes, and all bets are off.
This is Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. Truth or Dare? When was the last time you played the game? I remember back when I was in high school, Saturday night. We sat around and asked each other some really personal questions, daring one another to tell the truth or take a dare to do a stupid and sometimes dangerous thing, like eat a spoonful of bacon grease or streak across the neighbor's lawn. At Life of the Law, we produce investigative reports about the law. We also host live storytelling events all over the country, where we ask people to tell a story about a time when their life got entangled with the law. A couple of weeks ago, we took our live storytelling show to Brooklyn. First up, we'll start slow with a dare. Jocelyn Linder grew up in Columbus, Ohio. The state penitentiary played a pretty central role in the history of the town. And late one night, Jocelyn and some friends decided there was one thing they had to see. Here's Jocelyn.
The Ohio Penitentiary operated out of Columbus, Ohio, and it was 22 acres in the middle of downtown Columbus. The city actually grew up around it. And it had sort of this, a couple of famous people that had done time there. There was O. Henry, who wrote the delightful story, The Gift of the Magi, that you might know from Christmas. And there was a guy named Sam Shepard who supposedly killed his wife but blamed somebody else. And later it turned out maybe he was telling the truth. And later they made a movie about his life called The Fugitive. But he never really had the drama of the escape. Unfortunately, he died there. And in addition to having these criminals that sort of were, or non-criminals that were in the prison, it also was a place where 59 or 60 people, depending on who you ask, were executed, either by hanging or electrocution, and in the electric chair. So the prison was open until 1984, and then it moved to a small town outside of Columbus. And at the time, I was 9 years old and had grown up in Columbus my whole life and had no idea that this enormous complex was in the middle of my city. I guess it just wasn't something that would have been on my mind. And 9 years later, I was a senior in high school when Angie Chisholm, who was really pretty and sort of looked like Winona Ryder in Heathers, which was what we all wanted to look like in the 90s, approached me in the hallway and asked if I wanted to break into the Ohio Penitentiary with her and her boyfriend, Justin, and Colin Oden. So I was not the kind of person that broke into places most of the time. So and the other piece of this is that I am not really that into scary places. And Angie had sort of sold this as a quest to go find the electric chair, which supposedly still stood in the same spot on the grounds in a place called the Death House. And I was the kind of kid that could make any non-scary movie scary. I saw Splash and then was really scared I was gonna turn into a mermaid if I got in the bath, or Watership Down, I was scary talking rabbits, or Grease, I was terrified that I was gonna wake up and John Travolta was gonna be in my bedroom, which is that's a scary thing, right? So my initial and immediate thought was absolutely not. But then I had this little voice in the back of my head that was but Colin Oden is so cute. He was a guitar player and he had long hair, and I was so for whatever reason, I was okay. So now I'm going to break into the Ohio Penitentiary, which has been standing in ruin for 10 years at this point, 9 or 10 years. And in the middle of my city that I'd never noticed. And I'm driving there. And I pick everybody up. So maybe I was asked to go because I had a car. I don't know. It's all a little shady. But anyway, so I'm picking everyone up and we're driving to the pen. And everyone's talking about how this place is totally haunted. And I'm thinking as we're driving, okay, so here's my plan. I'm going to get there, I'm going to pull over, and I'm going to be like, you guys go ahead, I'm going to read. I'm just going to be right here, I'll be reading. Or I'll run and get some fast food, and I'll meet you back here in what, an hour? Like, I had this plan. I was like, not going to go. So we get there, but as we're pulling into, so we kind of pull into downtown, and over here is the overpass of the highway, and over here is the penitentiary, and over there are the buildings, and the area was not as populated as you would want for a person sitting alone in a car outside of a haunted penitentiary. Like, so I've started to have this like feeling like you're when you're on the roller coaster and you're like, I was gonna go. Like, I'm not gonna stay here by myself. So I pull over and I park the car and we all get out and we find the hole in the fence, which had been discussed earlier. And luckily, like, you didn't have to like shimmy in on your stomach or climb anything. It was just like a hole and you just kind of stepped through it. Which then begs the question, if like four high school kids found the hole in the, like, who else is inside the penitentiary? So anyway, we get in here and it's literally this ruin and it's kind of incredible. Like, we kind of entered and we're in the, oh my God, what is it called? The yard? What's the, like, where the, where you, the yard. So we're in the yard and there's like the guard towers. There's one that's very old looking and there's another one that's sort of more modern from the 80s. And we're walking through and it's like there's barbed wire coils. There's like big chunks of concrete. There are bricks. There's, you know, all these crazy things. And we're climbing over everything. And the first building we enter is the oh God, like words, the cell block. And it's like a, thank you. It's a three-story hallway that you can see on your left. There's like three stories of cells with the bars. And it's amazing. I mean, it was like, as we're walking sort of by each cell, there was maybe a bed with like the springs. There were things still on the walls. Some of them had toilets and sinks. I mean, it was just like amazing. And what I discovered in this moment as I'm walking through this cell block is that, like, I was not scared. And that was, like, pretty cool. I was like, okay, this is pretty cool. But we still hadn't gone on our real mission, which was to find the electric chair. So we leave the cell block, and now we're back in the yard, and we're, you know, it's just incredible. And we make our way over to where these guys said they had been looking for the electric chair for many years, I learned. So they were, this had been a mission of theirs. And they were discussing how when we found it, like, who's going to sit on it first? And I'm thinking, like, I'll totally take your picture. Like, that sounds great. And you know, we make our way over to where the hospital is, and we go inside, and again, it's like this eerie, sort of like just been abandoned. Like, they're gonna come back any minute and, you know, start their work day or whatever, what have you, at the prison. But, you know, it was like really, there were blankets on some of the beds, and the drawers were sort of half open and closed, and it was just really kind of an amazing connection to history that I never expected. And I don't remember how we got there, because not because I was that scared, but like literally this is like 1,000 years ago, but somehow we came out into a room and it was like in the middle of the room there was a platform, and on the wall of the platform there were black sort of like markings, and right there in the middle of the platform, just sitting there, was this metal folding chair. And it was really haunting. It just was by itself in the middle of this room that really looked like it could have been a room where people were electrocuted. And we all just stood there silently, just looking at it. And I think that probably everyone was wondering, like, who wants to sit on it? But nobody was moving. And then I have no idea why or what I was thinking, but I found myself walking toward it. And I climbed up on the platform, and I sat down on the chair. And then I got up, and I walked back. And I think that they went over and each sat on it. And we were all quieter than when we'd gotten there. I think we all sort of felt something. And we walked back to the gate, the fence, and we crawled out, got back in the car. a couple weeks later, call a note and ask me to prom. And then I didn't like him anymore because at the time I didn't like boys that liked me back. So it didn't work out. Different story. But I have to say that there was something really important about that day, about being 18 years old and being so afraid and then finding your strength in that fear. And then your life moving forward, scary or not, and realizing that you're going to be okay. Thank you.
That was Jocelyn Linder. Jocelyn's a writer and frequent contributor to NPR and This American Life. Once, she even appeared on The Ricky Lake Show. You can find more of her stories on her blog, jocelynlinder.com. Our next story is about a truth. It's from Larry Kay. He asked us not to reveal his full name. You see, Larry was born and raised in Cameroon, a country in Africa where it's not safe to be who you are.
Hello, everyone. My name is Larry, and I'm 23 years old. I moved to the United States about 4.5 years ago for grad school, as she mentioned. I was born and raised in Cameroon, a country in Central Africa where homosexuality is a crime. So in Cameroon, gay men and women can get arrested for up to 5 years and sent to jail for being who they are. And they have to pay a fine of about 200,000 francs, which is around $400. It doesn't sound like a lot, but it's a lot of money in Cameroon. So growing up there, you have, as a gay man, you have only one option, hiding. Hiding because if your neighbors suspect you to be gay, they can call the cops on you. If you look feminine, you can get arrested for being who you are and get sent to jail, and your life will be ruined forever. So growing up there, I was always asking myself, why me? Like, what did I do? I don't know. I didn't choose this. Like, what was wrong with me? And when I got to high school, things started getting more complicated. We didn't have internet at home, so one day I decided to stay a little bit longer at my high school to spend some time in the computer lab and check out this new gay dating website that I saw on TV called Gay Romeo. I created an account, and a few minutes later, I got a message from a guy called Eric. He was 21 years old, he was very handsome, tall, dark-skinned, and he was looking for friends. And I had never met anyone online before, so I was like, well, sure, why not? I'm going to give it a try. He wanted to meet in the next 30 minutes because he was at an internet cafe and he was running out of time. So he wanted to meet at a hotel because it was too risky to meet outside. At first, I was a little bit hesitant because I had never met anyone online before, and also I wasn't sure what to expect. So I decided to take the risk and go ahead and meet him in the lobby of Hotel Central. When we got there, we decided to take a room, to get a room, a really cheap room for the afternoon. And when we got to the reception, the lady, before handing us the key, gave us a very skeptical look, probably wondering, why are these two men getting a room in the middle of the afternoon? So we still got the keys, and when we got to the room and locked the door, I stopped for a second because I felt safe. For the first time, it was actually my first time being in a room with a man, and for the first time, I didn't have to worry about whispering or getting caught or feeling ashamed of being who I am. So we decided to lay down, cuddle, started talking about our lives and our dreams. He was a college student studying engineering, and he was waiting for the response from his scholarship to go to France to continue his studies. A few minutes later, we heard a violent bang on the door, and we both jumped from the bed, wondering what was going on. And I'm assuming the lady from the front desk probably alerted the neighborhood to let them know two men just got a room. So I jumped from the bed. Eric also jumped from the bed. I tried to run to the bathroom, but the guys broke in, and they asked us to stop. I tried to reach for my pen, but they told us to stop. And they told us that they were going to drive us outside naked and let the neighborhood decide on what to do with us. And I started crying because I knew there was no way I was going to make it out alive. Same for Eric. So I started crying, begging them to let us go, that we would never do it again, and they didn't want to hear anything. The first guy grabbed Eric, and he took him outside. And when the second guy was walking towards me, I got on my knees and started, like, crying, begging him, and I told him that I had money on me. And luckily, that morning, my dad gave me 100,000 francs, which is the equivalent of $100, which doesn't sound like a lot, but it was a lot to pay part of my school tuition. So I told him that I had money on me, and he asked me how much I had, and I told him the amount. He asked me to give him the money, so I reached for my bag, and I gave him the money that I had on me. He said it wasn't enough, that he would need more money. So for the next 5 months, he would show up at my school after class for me to pay pretty much for my freedom. I couldn't tell anyone about it. I couldn't tell my parents. I couldn't tell the cops. I couldn't tell my friends, because at the end of the day, I was a gay man in a country where I had no rights. Today, I live in New York, and it's been life-changing for me because I don't have to fear being who I am. I don't have to fear getting arrested for being a gay man here in New York. It took me some time to adjust because I have a boyfriend. He's here today in the back. And it took me some time to adjust because I was still uncomfortable holding his hand in public, or maybe sometimes he wanted to kiss me on the train, but I was always like watching my back, and I don't know, I still felt like there might be someone checking and someone who might do something. So I'm glad that he's been very patient with me, and today I think I kind of got over it. And before I end this today, I want you guys to close your eyes for a minute, really close your eyes, and imagine that right here, right now, you are living in a country where you could get arrested for being who you are or loving who you love. And now you can open your eyes. And I don't know if you felt anything, but I want you guys to be thankful. Thankful because you get to live in New York. You're lucky to live in New York. We're lucky to live in New York. And many don't get that chance. Thank you.
That was Larry Kay. Larry moved to the U.S. to get a master's degree in communications. He now lives and works in New York City. Our final storyteller is Mary Adkins. Mary's serious about the law. She went to Yale Law School and then straight into corporate litigation. But as it turns out, working in the law is different from living with the law. Here's Mary.
So on a lighter, more privileged note, in 2011, I sued UPS over a pair of shoes. It gets worse. I don't really want to get into why I owned a pair of $800 shoes because it's embarrassing. And not just because of the sequence of stories tonight. No, it really is. It was unlike me. It was 8 times more than any pair of shoes I had ever bought before. And that most expensive pair was a pair of Birkenstocks in about 1998. I don't go around dropping 3 figures on designer footwear, but I thought that they would make me happy at a time in my life when I was really miserable. I had gone to law school hoping to get a law degree to help people. And what I actually acquired there, interestingly, was more of a sense of the limits of the power of law to change people's lives. And so, kind of disenchanted with law, honestly, and with 6-figure student loan debt, I did what a lot of people with a law degree who have a lot of debt do, and I took a job in corporate law, specifically at a litigation department at a big law firm in Manhattan. Litigation is the kind of law where 2 sides are pitted against each other. It's antagonistic by definition. And I am not a person who has ever thrived on conflict. In 5th grade, on the girls' basketball team, I scored a basket, the only basket I scored all year, actually, for the wrong team, because I forgot that we weren't just sharing the baskets. My favorite story as a kid was the 3 Little Pigs told from the wolf's perspective, because I liked that it humanized him, in addition to anthropomorphizing him. I was not cut out to be a corporate litigator, and that was never more clear to me than after I had become one. I would sit at my desk for like 14 hours a day, feeling like I was living somebody else's life. And then it got kind of weird. Like, I started to become a little bit of a conspiracy theorist. I felt like the whole industry, which I still am a little bit of, I felt like the whole industry was profiting off of the perpetuation of conflict unnecessarily. And I would call my mom and whisper these things to her and say, like, the work I do is not just meaningless, but evil. And she would say, like, go take a walk and call me when you're feeling less dramatic. And so I would take these walks. And one day I took a walk over to Madison Avenue, where I went into the Christian Louboutin store and threw my credit card down and bought this pair, this exorbitant pair of shoes. And I don't know why I did it. I've like came up with a bunch of pithy reasons I could throw into the story about why. And I do think it had something to do with like trying, like my one last attempt to make this job work. Or maybe just feeling like if I was going to do a job that I hated that made a lot of money, I was going to do it in good shoes. I don't know. But I bought these shoes, and I took them back to my office, and I immediately put them in the corner where I never wore them because I couldn't actually bear the thought of messing up shoes that were that expensive by wearing them. So I left them there until about 6 weeks later when I actually got up the nerve to quit, to leave my job. And I put them on and went to the hiring partner's office and told him I was leaving law and that I was going to be a writer. And then I took them off and went to sing karaoke with my dad and sang Proud Mary, you know, the first line, left a good job in the city. And he sang Ike. So it was a good day. I wasn't wearing the shoes. So I took what little savings I had and moved to Brooklyn and broke my lease. And my plan was to tutor until I finished my first novel. I hadn't started writing the novel, but the idea was that I would finish it and then that would pay my bills. Right, it was fiscally very responsible. I still had the student loan debt, but I deferred my loans. And my medical plan for the year was just not to have any medical problems. So if $800 shoes ever made sense, they really didn't. They really didn't now. I put them on eBay, where they promptly sold to Yvonne in San Diego for $300, which was depressing, but it was $300. So I took them to my local UPS store on Flatbush in Brooklyn, where we are now. And you may know it. And left them there. I didn't put them in a shipping box. I left them in the pristine Christian Louboutin designer shoe box that I bought them in and went about my business. Well, a few days later, I heard from Yvonne, and she had not gotten the shoes. So I called the UPS store and left a message for the manager. And a few days later, I heard from Yvonne again, and she still hadn't received the shoes, and I still hadn't heard from the manager. If this were a movie, the next few months would be a montage of my escalating rage as I tried to track down this pair of shoes. eBay refunded Yvonne. I sent emails, I left messages, I left embarrassing Google and Yelp reviews that I'm ashamed of to this day. I filed a Better Business Bureau complaint, and finally that got a response from the UPS store. And the response was, we don't know where the shoes are, to be fair, but it's her fault because she didn't insure them. So I am not a person who likes conflict by nature, but there is a caveat to this, which is lose my shoes, and all bets are off. No, really, but cross me, and I still had a seed of a litigator in me. And so I sued the UPS store in Brooklyn, small claims. Small claims court is different from other courts in a lot of ways, but one way in which it's actually the same is that it's really overburdened. It's very congested. There are way more cases to be heard than there are people to hear them. And this really isn't judges. I mean, there's some judges, but you're lucky if you can get your case heard by an arbitrator who is a volunteer attorney. It's not uncommon to get a hearing date months after you file a complaint and for that hearing date to be rescheduled once or even multiple times. So by the time I actually found myself standing in the hallway of Brooklyn Small Claims waiting outside of this arbitration room, it was September. And I had canceled multiple classes I was supposed to teach, which I was doing to pay my bills, to attend multiple hearings. So it was no longer about the money, clearly, because I had foregone more in lost wages than I had lost on what these shoes actually sold for. And I wasn't even sure if UPS would show up. So part of me even then was wondering, like, what is this about? Why can't I let go? And part of it was that I needed the money. Like, I mean, yes, what I just said was true, but I also, I wasn't in a position to just be like, oh, $300, let it roll off my back. And the other part of me, the other part was that I like needed to live in a society. It was about the order of things, you know, like shoes shouldn't just be able to disappear into the ether and no one does anything about it. Thank you. So I was there and I didn't know if UPS would show up. Well, she did. She had on hot pink flats and dark wash jeans and a purse that matched her shoes. And standing outside this arbitration room, I introduced myself to her and learned her name was Camille. She looked thrilled to be there. Yeah, she looked like she hated me, which was fair because I hated her. So we were, you know, two equally matched sides. So we went into this arbitration room and the arbitrator asked us to each tell our sides of the story. And I started and I explained that I was asking for $2,000, which in reality I was doing to make Camille angry because she had made me angry for 6 months. But what I explained was that I wanted the retail value of the pair of shoes plus all of the money I had foregone in bringing the case. When I got to the part about leaving the shoebox without a shipping box at the store, the arbitrator raised her eyebrows, and I thought, okay, I'm good. Then it was Camille's turn, and she explained that she owned this UPS store with her brother, and they had for 7 years, and she wasn't there the day that I dropped off the shoes. She trusted her employees, but she didn't know what happened to them. And because of me, and she said this like she was really annoyed, because of me, she had to have this new process now where they had to track all of the packages when they came in and indicate like where they were and who was there and who was responsible for them until they got picked up by the truck. And it slowed everything down and it was super inefficient. And she would pay me the $300, but she was not gonna pay $2,000. And the arbitrator turned to me and said, will you accept $300? There's this phrase in civil law, to make someone whole. And I feel like the lawyers in the room are like, yeah. To make someone whole, it refers to when someone sues for monetary damages and they've been injured. What amount is going to compensate them for that injury? What amount is going to make them whole again? And it's a pretty absurd calculus regardless to try to put a monetary value on something that's happened to someone, but it's really absurd when you talk about traumatic things like losing a loved one or becoming paralyzed. This was just a pair of shoes, but it was a really fucking nice pair of shoes. And I had spent months fighting this. Still, when she said that, I said yes, because it was clear that this was where this ended. Like, I wasn't going to get more than 300, and I wasn't sure that I needed to. And thinking about this case later and thinking over the previous 8 months of my life, I thought about how I had left law so full of cynicism and so convinced that it did more harm than good. And then immediately found myself in court as the plaintiff. And it may have just been small claims, and it may have just been this really petty battle over something as superficial as a pair of shoes, but it had actually done something to restore some of my faith in the power of law, because court was where we reached a resolution when nothing else had worked. And Camille's business was actually running better because of it, even though she was annoyed by that. And I could move on with my non-litigator life. Thank you.
That was Mary Adkins. Mary actually was the creator of our live storytelling series at Life of the Law. We're so happy she joined us and finally told her story. This live episode of Life of the Law was produced by Ashley Cleek and Jonathan Hirsch, with sound design by Jonathan. We hold live storytelling events all over the country. In fact, the next one's inside San Quentin State Prison. If you have a story you want to tell or you'd like us to hold a storytelling event in your town, go to our website, lifeofthelaw.org, where you can subscribe to our newsletter and write us an email. We'd love to hear from you. Life of the Law is a nonprofit project of the Tide Center, and we're part of the Infinite Guest Network of podcasts from American Public Media. You can hear all of our episodes, stories about selecting juries, legal rights to water, and bounty hunters at infiniteguest.org, lifeofthelaw.org, iTunes, Stitcher, or on your favorite podcast app. If you'd like to hear our Life of the Law stories on your local public radio station, give them a call and let them know they can get access to all of our episodes at PRX, Public Radio Exchange. We're funded in part by grants from the Open Society Foundations, the Law and Society Association, the Proteus Fund, and the National Science Foundation. But the most important production support Life of the Law receives comes from you, our listeners. Take a minute and visit our website. Make a tax-deductible donation at the end of the year to help pay for the direct costs of producing our stories. There's a donate button on the top right corner. Next on Life of the Law, space.
In fact, there was a case in Europe where there was somebody who claimed to own the sun because he bought it on the internet. And then there was somebody who got a sunburn. So he sued the guy who owned the sun.
That's next on Life of the Law. I'm Nancy Mullane. Thanks for listening. Thank you.